Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Hello and welcome. I have news for you. The news is that you should prepare yourself. Seriously, prepare yourself because you are about to get notified.
KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Well, good morning, everyone. This is Ryan Fulland, also known as the DJ Ginger MC, hashtag Ginger MC, and I'm speaking to you here about social media. That's what we do every Wednesday morning from 8 to 9. And at the end of the day, social media is an amplification tool. It is a way to communicate with the world. One of the other ways that we all communicate is visual and audio. And you, when you put those together, usually there's this thing called movies and movie making. And from a history of the last, 100, 200 years, the evolution of film and the evolution of filmmakers has revolutionized the way that filmmakers can communicate. Everything from technology to just our awareness of the medium of film to express ideas and communicate globally on issues that matter, on issues to make us laugh. And today I have a very special guest who is solving one of the biggest problems that filmmakers have, if not the biggest, bloodiest problem that they experience on a daily basis. And it's what makes them stressed out. It's what makes them lose their hair, lose their wife, lose their life at the end of the day. But I'm excited because our guest here, Mr. Chai Forrest. Yes, Chai Forrest sounds like a good tea. Even better than a good tea, this man is going to help the world of filmmakers in their challenge of the thing called sustainable funding. That's right. If you've ever tried to make a film, it costs money. And the problem is no one wants to give you money to make the film until you're established and you've got the chicken and the egg. So, Chai, good morning. Have you had any chai tea this morning?
Actually, I drove through the Starbucks drive-through down the street and just got a grande Americano with a splash of almond milk.
So, are you a chai tea fan at all?
Actually, I don't. I really like a good strong coffee.
Yeah, I'm an Americano as well, but now Starbucks has the coconut milk. So I throw some coconut milk in there with a little splash of Splenda. I'm not a splash, like a full Splenda. And I try to stay away from the half and half to keep my cholesterol down, you know?
Nice. Yeah, the coconut milk's good. I'm definitely all about the almond milk or the coconut milk. Bring it on.
Well, I'm sure we could make a movie about the history of almond milk or coconut milk. You can pretty much make a film about everything. And I'm passionate about films. I've been making films for years. I have a degree in dramatic art that happened by accident, but that's a different story. I've been involved in small projects, big projects. Just completed a 9-year project on a documentary that we actually just won the Golden Palm at the Beverly Hills Film Festival, which is really exciting. And that's kind of funny because that's where I met you, Chai. I was dressed up in a half suit, which is like my slacks and nice shoes and a tank top because we're in LA. So sometimes I don't get fully dressed until the red carpet hits. But you were doing something with a camera and it came up that I was going to the Beverly Hills Film Festival. We did a fun little interview. Recently saw you again at the dojo, again behind the camera. And I think you've got a really interesting story. And I'm excited today to talk about like where you came from, everything from being your classic broke, living in the car, endless dead-end jobs, to what sort of brought you to where you are now, as probably maybe the exact same thing, but you're an entrepreneur and you're going to change that. And then what you're doing for the film industry, I think, is incredible. And then I'm interested in how you're communicating this with the world, what social media you're leveraging. I know you're big on Facebook. Maybe we'll bring you around to getting excited about Twitter by the end of the show, but it's okay. And so let's learn more about you. I mean, rather than read your interesting bio, I'd rather hear it from you so everybody can get to know you a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Ryan, for having me here. Yeah, when we did first meet, you were rushing into the dojo, the Expert Dojo in Santa Monica, and you were looking really sharp, like you always do. And you just came in. I think you were on your way to the Beverly Hills Film Festival, which then I believe you guys won. You're a producer on a film that won the top award for documentary.
Yeah, we actually it was the top award of the entire festival. So all categories were into the one Golden Palm, and then we won that, and we also won Best Foreign Film. So we came out with two trophies. I was doing my patented jump sidekick in front of the backdrop on the red carpet, and yeah, it was fun.
And tell me refresh my memory of the film and what it was about really quick.
Yeah, so it's called Tupamaro, and we don't have it really publicly out there yet, though you can find the trailer on YouTube. And it was a 9-year project where we went to Venezuela and Caracas, and we followed one of the lead members in the Tupamaro group. And it's an interesting path, and I'm not going to get too into it, but basically, imagine if the police were corrupt and you don't feel safe, so you gather a bunch of buddies and you basically try to police yourself. So you had these gangs that some thought were vigilantes, some thought were revolutionaries, and that's really the crux of the dialogue that we're trying to share, because these individuals were trying to police the police because of so much corruption. And there was an actual coup which they supported, which was unsuccessful. That coup's leader was put in jail. When that leader came out, he took the supporters from the coup and put them in public office. So imagine having someone who was a professed cop killer now in charge of the police, all in an effort to sort of make safety and life more livable, essentially. And then you've got all this political unrest, and then you get factions that are dividing. And we follow this one guy's story through this entire time. And it's an incredible, heartwarming, crushing story that the message in the end is that when violence propagates violence, it's still going to be messy. Because here he is as a public figure, and the whole documentary ends with his nephew, who shot 8 times in the back, the only person in their family that actually graduated college, and he had just graduated. And so now that our main character, Chino, you know, everything about him wants to sort of, you know, create sort of social justice. And then he says, I'm going to go find these guys and take care of them. So it's a really an inside look behind the scenes on what's been happening in Caracas, and there's still so much unrest right there. That's what makes it so timely. But at the end of the day, that the powerful tool of film is being able to tell personal stories, tell real stories, tell fictional stories. But I mean, funding is always an issue, and over 9 years we invested a lot, and if we had more help in that process, man, that would have made our life a lot easier.
And what was your involvement, and how did you get access to be able to film that content?
I was the executive producer on it, and in college, we had a theater troupe and production group called the Sherwood Players. And one of our buddies, he graduated with journalism. He went to Caracas. He was a journalist in Caracas. And he was like, you guys would not believe the people that I'm meeting. And I built a relationship with this guy who used to be like, you know, the biggest gangster in town, who is seen as a gangster, but also seen as a revolutionary. There's a really dynamic situation going on here. So we raised some capital. We sent, we got our film crew over there. I think we went back like 5 or 6 times with individuals from here, from the U.S., as a part of this process. Our buddy Marty, you know, he found a wife, had a kid over there, and it's just this really organic process. And as history went on, things physically changed, so we kept going back. And then the difficult part was to patch it all together in the end. And we were fortunate to get Ed Asner on board, also as an executive producer, and he narrates it. So it was a fun learning experience. But even as a team, over 9 years, there's a lot of personal differences. So whatever project you're working on, you know, it's a project. There's a few moving pieces. But it's
and so, especially with a documentary, the hardest part is then condensing those 9 years into 60 minutes or 80 minutes, whatever the final cut was.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of an analogy for communication in life. Like, I'm assuming that I don't want to ask how old you are, but let's say you're early 20s, maybe. Is that how old you are?
We can somewhere in there.
All right. I
can tell you how much I weigh, but not my age.
So the idea here is that, like, let's say you've got 25, 30 years under your belt. Like, that is your own life. That is your own documentary. And the struggle is not bringing that down to an hour and a half, but bringing that down to 10 or 15 seconds, right? How do you communicate your own documentary and your story when you've been filming through your own eyes your whole life? That's what I get really excited about. And that's really where a personal brand comes involved, is how do you, I guess personal branding is like editing your own movie of your entire life and presenting it in a way that is intriguing and exciting and of value to people who want to watch it, right? Imagine if you had to sit there and watch everyone's life, like a full documentary, like of all their 30 years. It would be boring. It wouldn't be engaging. Like, it just wouldn't work. That's only like with one person. So the art of storytelling, whether it's through the lens to communicate to an audience, it's the same thing, I think, of how do you communicate what you are as a movie to someone. There's a trailer, right? There's an extended version. There's probably behind the scenes director's cuts. But the only way you're going to get people interested in that is if you get them to want to watch the movie or want to read your bio or want to work with you. So here I am going down into the vortex of the communication rabbit hole. But I mean, it's exciting because at the end of the day, filmmaking, personal branding, business, it's all about storytelling. You've got to curate those stories. And your story is one of helping people fund their stories.
And I think one of the key elements of that is, as a filmmaker, we have to invite our potential audience, our fans, into our process, into our creative process. And before, we used to have DVDs where you would get all this behind-the-scenes content and the director's commentary. And now we've actually kind of lost that with Netflix. They just go right to the next movie. You don't even get to really watch the credits on a movie. And so we lost one of the best parts of DVDs, which are the bonus content. And that bonus content is what allows the audience to really connect with the filmmaker. You know, even listening to those directors' commentaries, the audio is really a great connection that the audience gets to listen to the filmmaker, you know, what they went through while they're making that film. And so the power of social media today is that you can, you know, live stream from behind the scenes throughout your entire creative process. Imagine being able to do a live stream right into your Facebook page, invite your fans in, you're casting your film or you're doing a storyboard, and then you go, you're actually shooting, you're in the middle of the desert or you're in the middle of the jungle, and you're inviting your fans into that process. And hey guys, you know, we're out here in the middle of the jungle, we're about to shoot this scene, and then you wrap that up and now you're in post-production and you're inviting you're working with an amazing sound designer, and you invite the fans in for that process, and then cut to the red carpet. Now you've gotten to a film festival, and now you've taken the fans on this amazing journey through your creative process, which I think is aspirational, inspirational, probably really educational. And now, by the time you release that movie, if you've invited the fans through this entire process, instead of saying, "Hey, crossing the finish line, finally having your movie done," and then saying, "Hey, here's my movie," instead, they already know you have your movie done because they've taken the journey with you.
So you're essentially trying, like, imagine if over the last 9 years, everybody that knew that I was doing this was along for the entire ride. And there's a certain amount of select people that know that, and we had versions that we would show along the way, but it was still very, I guess, stealth mode. And social media wasn't really at the level it was 9 years ago, to sort of start that process. And yeah, I agree. If I had people to follow that journey along the way, we would just have that much more traction right now, and maybe double down on that traction and say, "Hey guys, here's our next project. Who wants to get involved financially or even support wise and something like that?" Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and that's the power of social media, is the mistake that I made working on my documentary, which took about 10 years to do. I followed convenience store clerk Mitch Austin, who was working a late night shift 2 days after Christmas. He was shot 7 times in a brutal robbery. 3 guys came in, just started shooting him. They didn't even, you know, try to rob him. They just walked in, started shooting him. He was on the ground. They were just pumping him full of bullets. They made him get up, open the cash register, shot him once more in the head, and just left. And they took about $70 and a couple of cartons of cigarettes.
Oh, my God.
He laid there dying. He recounts the story in my film about how he saw angels catching each one of the bullets as they were shooting him. It's an incredible story. And it took me 10 years to film, to keep going back, interviewing Mitch as he was healing from those gunshot wounds. He miraculously survived. I tell the story of Elizabeth Garcia, a single mother of 3 kids, 22 years old, on her 3rd night working at a convenience store, was abducted, raped, and stabbed 57 times and left to die behind that convenience store.
Mm.
And, you know, during this process of making this film, I found out that 300 convenience store clerks are killed every year in America. And it was a huge eye-opener for me. And so I actually started a social media campaign. Rather than waiting for some law to change or some corporation to make it safer for convenience store clerks, you know, I started a little Instagram social media campaign called #HugAClerk. And the idea of that is, like, if we go into our local convenience store and just say thank you to that clerk on the other side of the counter, give them and say, hey, you know, thank you, I really appreciate you're here working, you know, just trying to work an honest day's work, you know, give them a hug, take a photo, hashtag it, hug a clerk. And that way the community has their back, and we show that we actually have empathy for that person behind the convenience store counter.
Wow.
And that's a powerful way to use social media to really call attention to an issue that's here right in our own backyard, our own communities, that's not really being talked about. You know, it doesn't really make the news when a convenience store clerk gets shot, because it's so common. And that's kind of sad in it of itself, is that it's, oh, you work at a convenience store, yeah, that's just part of the job, you know, getting shot and robbed, you know. That shouldn't be that way.
Wow, that's crazy. So, real quick, let's take a, speaking of social media, why don't you give some shameless plugs and let people know where you are so we can find you, and then I'm going to formulate a tweet during that time. So tell us how we find you online. What are your social media platforms of choice?
Yeah, actually, I really am all about Facebook Live. So my personal profile is actually kind of my business page, too. I've just really tried to leverage that. I just love Facebook Live. It's just super easy to be able to do. And it's just a way to, like, you click, you know, go live on your phone or your computer anywhere, and you can really, you know, invite the fans in. So if anyone wants to find me on Facebook, I will absolutely be your friend. And just Chai Forrest, C-H-A-I-F-O-R-E-S-T. And the rest of my social media is just at Chai Forrest. I also am doing an ongoing series called Hacking Hollywood. It's I'm telling the untold stories of Hollywood talent and filmmakers, and starting an ongoing interview and kind of a fireside chat series called Hacking Hollywood. And that's actually how I met you, Ryan. I'm interviewing you for that series that's in development right now. And so any filmmakers out there that want to reach out, my email is just CF, which is Triforce, at hackinghollywood.tv.
So I'm putting here the untold stories of Hollywood talent. Check out hackinghollywood.tv. Any filmmakers,
yes,
who want to, what, get involved or get interviewed? What is it?
Yeah. Tell your story, you know, what you went through, your journey, what film you're working on. But rather than even the specific project, I'm really interested in filmmakers' stories, how they got to be a filmmaker, what ups and downs they've had, what mistakes they've made, what successes they've had, and to be able to create a really, you know, knowledge base around our collective experiences.
Very
and
cool.
And that's the idea behind Hacking Hollywood. And the hack in Hollywood is really growth hacking. I was inspired by the idea when I had finished editing my film in October 2016, I hit another brick wall. I had invested everything I had into post-production. I didn't even think I was going to finish the film, so I titling and music design and just trying to make the best film I could with the resources I had. And when I finished it, I hit another roadblock, which was, oh, wow, I actually have to market this film. I have to submit it to festivals, which cost money. I have to distribute this movie, whether it's self-distribution or otherwise. And, you know, that's a huge undertaking. Even submitting a film to a festival, if you get into, let's say, even Sundance, that could cost a filmmaker thousands of dollars in travel fees and publicity and marketing to do it correctly. And I quickly realized I wasn't the only filmmaker that hit that brick wall, that there were thousands of other filmmakers with finished films that couldn't get that film to their audience, that couldn't market that film simply because they didn't have the budgets to do it. They hadn't built up their social media following. They hadn't set aside enough funding for the marketing. And Hollywood studios, they'll spend half of the budget. They spend $100 million on producing a movie. They'll spend $100 million on marketing that film. And they have an incredible system where they literally flip a switch. They plaster billboards, bus ads. They send their actors and talent on all the late-night shows, which they own. And so they have a tried-and-true marketing system when they release a film. And filmmakers, independent filmmakers, don't have that luxury. You know, when we make a film, we invest so much time, energy, our heart and soul into it, and we don't have the luxury of being able to make 10 films, lose money on 9 of them, make the money back on the 10th film. You know, we have to make sure that we're budgeting correctly and making money on each film that we're producing so that we can get on to the next film.
And I think that type of sort of hand-to-mouth from the filmmakers who are really at the forefront of creation is a real struggle, right? I mean, you do everything you can to raise the funds to produce it, and then squeeze through to figure out how to edit it, and then you still have extra costs that you didn't think of, and somehow you figure that out. Now you've got this amazing product with this amazing story that can affect people and change lives, and then how do you get people to watch it, right? I mean, that's a real struggle.
It's actually, this reminds me of the story you tell. You did a little talk at the Expert Dojo last week that I helped film, and you were talking about if you had the cure for cancer and sitting here right in your pocket, what good is it if you can't get it to the person, the patient, and then get that patient to take it, right? It's the same thing. You have this finished film with this incredible message, this story that needs to get told, and if you can't get it out to your audience, it's just sitting there on your hard drive. It's just sitting there, you know, on a digital shelf.
Yeah, and the problem is that a lot of times you think you have the cure to cancer, and you're so focused on that, you forget about how expensive it is to find the people with the cancer, right? Crazy.
Exactly. That's the whole other side of the equation. That's so many filmmakers, and it's not anything. It's because, you know, when you make a film, you're thinking about the story. You're not thinking about your target market and who your audience is and doing focus groups. You're telling the story. I mean, when I started filming this documentary about convenience store violence, I was telling Mitch Austin's story. I didn't sit there and go, well, is this, you know, what's my target market for this film? You know, so I put everything into just telling that story, doing the best job I could, and then putting everything into completing it, because that's really a challenge. A lot of people start projects and they don't finish. It can take years to do a film or a documentary. And so just you're thinking about just finishing it. And then when you finally do cross that finish line, then now you're like, oh my God, this is just the beginning.
Exactly. And it is just the beginning. Then even when it's finished, you know, how do you stay relevant for a long time after that fact? Hey, real quick, just as I'm going to send a tweet out, you said you're on Facebook Live. Are you on Twitter?
Yes. My Twitter, I believe, just @ChaiForest. Yes, just @ChaiForest.
Okay, sweet. Just want to make sure that I had that correct there.
And you can go ahead and sell me on Twitter. Sometimes they hear Twitter's dead. You know, it's
what?
I think,
what? Who told you that?
Sell me on Twitter and, you know, tell me the high points of why being on Twitter is a powerful thing.
Well, I could tell you that right now, that you have a very active and engaged community. It's a real-time platform, so you can find out what's happening right now. It's not a platform that you have to really limit yourself to one post a day, sort of like an Instagram or Facebooky where I know people aren't limited, but you know, you sort of have to really sit there and think about, and each sort of post is like this crazy post, versus Twitter, more of just what you're thinking at the moment, or relevance that you see, or something that your thought process is. So it's a lot quicker of a platform, at least, to deliver on. And I think that the fact that you only have 140 characters makes you really condense what you're saying, that makes you think about it more. Now, granted, there's a lot of tweets that are just totally nonsense, or totally trolled, or totally dumb, or whatever else, and you're going to have that on any platform. So whatever platform it is, you know, you're the one that decides how you want to use it. And I just love Twitter as a platform because I don't get lost into this crazy matrix of vortex Facebook extended comments of long stuff where it takes so much time to work through. And for me, Twitter is an amazing connectivity tool. Like, anybody can reach out to me on Twitter and I can spark a conversation. I've met and connected with so many people versus a Facebook where you have this almost a couple degrees that you have to get through to really connect. And then there's just a lot of noise. So those are my kind of top reasons for Twitter. I think it's definitely not dead. It's just that there's not everyone on it, just like any platform. And I think from social media, I talk about this all the time. Find a platform that you like and then just own it. I think too many people are too spread thin on platforms, and they're trying to be all things to all people on all platforms. And there's no shame in just being like, well, I really like this one. Well, great. You know, it's
and tell me what is Twitter doing with the live TV? I know they just introduced live. Can you go live? Tell me the latest with the live feature in Twitter.
Yeah. So it's Periscope is the functionality, and it's a standalone app, and they're owned by Twitter, and it's a classic live streaming service where then you can announce that you've gone live on Twitter, and it is a live streaming, so you're like a live broadcast. And there's an interactive map where you can see, based on location, like a heat map, who is periscoping at what time. And I don't periscope as much because when I'm at an event, I'd rather be engaged in the event and then pull relevant information out and tweet it as it goes, because you can't really be on Periscope and tweet at the same time, or at least I find that to be difficult. And sometimes for me, the live streaming, if it's just like a cell phone in the back of a room of a conference that's like the speaker's, you know, 50 feet away and the audio is not that great. For me, my own personal viewing experience, sometimes it's not the best experience, or it doesn't have the energy of the room. So I'll see people jump on and it's like, so I think that for me, live stream, when used in a way that you're really producing something that is organic, it doesn't have to be highly produced, but if the audio is great and it's cropped well and it doesn't feel like you're in the back of the audience filming something where I just can't even see somebody on stage because they're all blown out because the lights are in their face, for me, I'm just more of a snippet update kind of guy.
And, you know, one of the big issues is discovery. And, you know, problem with Facebook is discovery. And, you know, you mentioned that there's a few layers you have to go through to even find someone. You have to, you know, send them a friend request or like their page. You know, and so there is a lot of barriers to entry. I think there's no discovery happening on Facebook. Absolutely. What kind of discovery is happening in Twitter? I mean, how can you find people pretty quick?
Sure. I typically, first thing I'll do if I'm meeting somebody or I'm being introduced, I'll just straight up Google their name and then Twitter. And Twitter is very high ranking for SEO, and a lot of times you can find the person you're looking for very easy just Googling them. It's not as easy on the platform because you have to know their name, and sometimes the searches, it comes up with, you know, because your actual name can be different than your handle. So if I just search for Chai Forest, it might or might not come up, but if I search for at Chai Forest, I'll get you on the dot. So I would have then gone to Google and said Chai Forest Twitter, and it usually pops that up right there. But as far as how to search on Twitter, it's not like an Instagram where the more hashtags are the better. It's where the more relevant hashtags are more relevant. And so I'd never suggest to use more than 3 hashtags in a tweet. That's just because it makes it unreadable. you always have to look at a tweet and go, can I read this very easily? And if it's like hashtag this and at symbol this and hashtag, 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 it hurts your eyes because the hashtags are a different color. But
what kind of engagement are you getting when you do post a tweet? And talk to me a little bit about the engagement.
Sure. So I do a daily post of a stick figure drawing that I do every day. And let me just click on the one that I have from, what is this? This was on the 31st. So I posted this on Sunday. No, on Monday. And I've got 146 likes, 80 retweets, and 9 different comments that have been in a threaded conversation back and forth. So that's a pretty highly engaged tweet for just one tweet. But I have a lot of followers, though, too, so it's all relative at the end of the day. The nice thing about Twitter, though, is that when using hashtags, it doesn't matter how many followers you have, right? Facebook gets crazy with algorithms, and really your visibility is based on what they think, based on the algorithm that they put together. And on Twitter, when you're using a hashtag, it's sort of anybody's game. And that's how you can get involved and find conversations. So a hashtag, for everybody that is out there, I think it's still kind of a concept that's hard to really take in. I'm still trying to explain to my mom what a hashtag is. And she's like, well, I want to hashtag. I want to do it. I'm like, well, you don't just really do it, Mom. But what's fun on the show here is I have this concept called a GTO. And I always like to ask people how they would describe a hashtag. And we'll get back to how you can use hashtags on Twitter to engage in conversation, find, search, and create conversation. But if you were to explain to your grandma or your grandpa, okay, we call this a GTO, a grandma timeout, how would you explain a hashtag to them?
You're asking me?
Say that again?
You're asking me?
Like, because I know how I would describe it, but I have a lot more fun hearing how other people describe it because, I mean, to each his own, but a hashtag is still a hashtag. So GTO hashtag, how would you explain it?
The first thing I would say is not something you smoke. So when you heard the word hash,
okay, good.
Not something you smoke, you know, it's totally legal.
Yeah.
And I would say a hashtag is just a very quick way to aggregate all of the topics around one subject. So if I created a hashtag called hug a clerk around a campaign idea of hugging a clerk every time you go into a convenience store, then anytime anyone tags a post related to that, it's queued up into the same little bin.
So check this out. I just used on hashtag, I just did hashtag hug a clerk. And okay. I've got, it looks like you hugs and smiles with some convenient clerk there. You again with hug a clerk and image. You hugging another lady who is a clerk. A tweet that I just put out, it says, talking with Chai of Hacking Hollywood TV on KUCI-FM. Did you know that 300 convenience store clerks are killed each year? Hashtag hug a clerk. And what I did is I made it a poll. So there's 4 options, like a multiple choice. I said, what? The second one was, that seems like a lot. The next one was, I don't believe it. And the next one is, I totally believe it. So in the last, whatever, in the last 10 minutes, I've got 37 votes. And right now, 43% of people say, I totally believe it. 14% wow. say they don't believe it. 24% seems like a lot. And 19% just chose, what? So, I mean, here's a hashtag, like you said, is a way to organize topics on a conversation. And by simply, if somebody's listening and they're like, oh, hashtag hug a clerk, that sounds cool. If you were to go to the World Wide Web and just try to find it on your own, you might get totally lost. But this hashtag hug a clerk, it pulls up the relevant conversation, including a poll that I just put out, right? So I think that's a great explanation of a hashtag, and that's how, you know, you can use it to engage on different platforms. Now, it's different on different platforms, but there's value in having, it's like a Dewey Decimal System online, where you're like, you need to find that one book, so you go find that one card, and then the card leads you exactly in this big maze or the library of where the conversation is happening.
Wow, yeah, that's incredible. 39 votes within a few moments. That's engagement. Well, I am sold. I definitely could say Twitter is not dead. It's alive and well.
Hey,
and
yay!
It's got a whole new chapter. I'm excited. You sold me on it. I'm definitely gonna step up my Twitter game, 100%. I think the hardest thing, and maybe you could give me some advice on this. You know, you do have, you're saying it, focus on one platform and crush it. Do it really well on that platform. So how do you pick that platform? You know, I've been doing Facebook Live, which I love, but there's not a lot of reach or discovery. Where Twitter, it's great, obviously has a lot of engagement. So how do you, maybe you pick two out of the four, you know, there's Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. How do you pick the one or two and really crush it there?
So that is like the ultimate question. And I think a lot of people that are listening are going, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I want to know. So let me give you my opinion on it. And it's not the ultimate opinion. It's just the opinion of a ginger. So it definitely is heavily weighted from a legitimacy standpoint. But it's just my opinion. Like for me, I'm on Facebook, although I haven't posted. I don't remember the last time I posted on my personal Facebook. Like it has been before January 1st. But I'm there. Wow. I'm on it so people can find me. Because I would speak at events and people would be like, I can't find you. So from a visibility standpoint, don't get me wrong, it's okay to be on a platform and not crush it, right? But if somebody talks to me, and I think when we have this conversation, you're like, oh, what's your Facebook? I'm like, I'm not really into Facebook, but you could tweet me or email me. It's really just about finding what you like. And you said a very magic word. You said, I love Facebook Live as a platform. Ding, 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 ding. Like, that should be a recognition that that's something that you should figure out how to own and continue to invest your time in. Twitter, you're sort of now maybe being able to get excited about it. And sure, you might be able to use Twitter to push engagement to your Facebook. And you might be able to use Snapchat to find a specific audience and then share with them things and eventually push them to your Facebook. So you can use the different platforms to sort of focus and bring things together. And at the end of the day, what I believe social media has a very high value of doing is redirecting traffic to where you want. So if you go to any of my social media platforms, they all lead to ryanfolan.com. So at the end of the day, your website is the only thing that you own online. And social media platforms are going to change. They're going to go out of business. There's going to be new ones. There's going to be mergers. There's going to be all kinds of crazy stuff that happens. But at the end of the day, if you have a website or a home base or something to guide people back to, then your social media channels are just a fun tool to amplify the message that eventually you want to bring them back to somewhere else. So I always encourage people that like the end destination should be your home, should be where you're bringing people, like your storefront or, you know, this, all of your information. And there's a huge discoverability issue with Facebook, but Facebook Live is a way to break out of that bubble. But again, I hope that answered the question. It's like, find the social medias that you enjoy from a functional standpoint. Like, I like the function of Twitter. I don't like the function of Facebook. So I've invested my time into tweeting and I've yielded results and I get leads off of that and I make connections and I make friends and things like that. But at the same time, I'm on Instagram and I contacted you through Instagram because I knew you were there, right?
Yeah, I was going to mention that. It was really cool. It was actually my first direct message I got through Instagram. I looked down at my phone and I had a message from Ryan Folan on my Instagram, and I was like, oh, this is cool. And I clicked back and we communicated like regular instant messaging through our little Instagram, and I thought that was a really cool feature. Is that in, tell me about that capability in Twitter.
So there's direct messaging through Twitter as well. There's direct messaging. It's almost like a Facebook Messenger, how you message somebody individually. And Instagram is highly underutilized when it comes to the DMing. And Gary Vaynerchuk has recently talked a lot about this. The most underutilized tools for marketers is Instagram direct messaging. Because here's a great example. I'm like, you're on Instagram, but you'd never gotten a direct message. It's because everybody sort of plays in the public profile. So I've been playing around with using direct messaging. It's almost like, imagine somebody outside of your house in the street yelling something as they're driving by. that's kind of what your post is a lot of times. Like, it's just if you happen to be in the house or you happen to have the door open, you might hear somebody screaming or playing music or the ice cream truck, whatever that is, because that's what happens when you scroll through your feed. You know, Instagram will decide who you see and not, and maybe you don't scroll all the way down. Maybe you scroll down very fast. So a post on Instagram is like the ice cream truck driving down your street, and you don't really have any control whether you hear it or not, right? Maybe it's a sponsored ad, which is a louder volume, and you have a better chance of hearing it, but you still might not hear it. So a direct message is like that. The ice cream truck stops in front of your house, gets out of the door, walks up, knocks on your door, and he waits until you open the door and then sees you face to face, and he's like, hey, bro, you want an ice cream?
Something you said about playing around with it is, I think, is a really key word, because I think a lot of times, you know, we walk on, you know, we tiptoe around social media sometimes. I like, you know what, just go into a feature, start playing with it. I love the idea that you know, and that kind of is opening it up to me. It's like, don't be intimidated by something with a feature within it. And, I'm going to really pursue the direct messaging, and I love, really exploring that in the Twitter. Just using each, getting into a platform and then exploring the different features of it to kind of open new doors within that.
So here's a question for you. I mean, who is it that you're trying to get in front of? And this is an open conversation for anyone if you were to ask yourself that same question. Who do you want to get in front of? And social media is an amazing way to find, join conversations, engage, and connect with those people. Like, so you want to connect with people in Hollywood who have stories that are untold, right?
Yes, filmmakers. We didn't get into this yet, but so I have my ongoing TV series, Hacking Hollywood, where I interview filmmakers, creatives living and working in Hollywood, who are, you know, cracking the code, making it happen, showing up and making the films, to tell their stories. And the other platform that I've been working on for the last year, and something how I met you, actually, I went through startup school at the Expert Dojo. It was an accelerator program for 10 weeks. With Brian McMahon, and it was an incredible program, and it helped me really shape the platform, which I now have, called LightsCamera.fund. LightsCameraFund is a funding platform for filmmakers and creators so that they can build sustainable businesses through fan membership. And it's simply, hey, you know, you're my fan, you're following me on all these social media platforms, you know, you're a subscriber to my YouTube channel. Why not come on to Lights, Camera, Fun, become a true super fan, a producer fan for $5, $10, $20 a month, and support me on an ongoing basis, and that way I can build, imagine if you had 100 super fans on Lights, Camera, Fun, you know, for the price of two cups of coffee, $10, they become true fans, and that's $1,000 a month coming in that you can budget. Imagine if you scaled that to 1,000 producer fans on Lights, Camera, Fun at $10 a month. That's $10,000 that you now have as a filmmaker, as a content creator, as a storyteller, to be able to budget, to be able to pay your team, to be able to pay your talent. Imagine that, being the filmmaker that actually like pays their crew, that pays their talent, pays them what they're worth and for their time, rather than be like, yeah, we'll just pay for gas and your lunch. You're actually like paying them the rate that they're worth. And when you're getting $10,000 every month from your 1,000 super fans or producer fans on Lights, Camera, Fun, that's a powerful thing. People are going to want to work with you. You're going to get more productivity done, more projects out the door. And I'm really excited to see as I launch this. We're in beta right now. We're probably going to go live in the next couple of weeks. It's called LightsCameraFun.com or just LightsCamera.fun. The idea is just building a fan membership business for filmmakers and content creators.
So here's a perfect example of where you can leverage social media to hopefully get in front of two sides of your market. Those people who are artists that need support, and then the super fans that have artists that they want to support but don't have a platform to do it on, right?
Okay.
So tell me who your ideal target market is.
So as far as content creators and filmmakers, I'm focusing specifically right here in Los Angeles, right here in Hollywood, it's not exclusive to that, but I really want to serve the creative community right here and focus on that. So micro-targeting locally Los Angeles, Hollywood filmmakers, independent filmmakers, anyone that's using a camera to tell a story, the untold stories of our times.
Okay, so what are some keywords that you would think of that are associated with this type of demographic?
I would say filmmaker, storyteller, creator, producer, executive producer.
Okay, and I'll stop you there.
Okay.
What I'm doing is I'm helping you to identify this market, to communicate it. Then I'm asking you what keywords would be associated. And if you take those keywords and you add the good old hashtag in front of it, now you have a very direct, almost think of it like a scope, like an online scope, like on a that you can see into, or maybe a microscope, and you can dwindle this down. So I just typed in hashtag filmmaker to Twitter, and
wow,
there are thousands of tweets of people, everything from snapshots of the movies they're making to little trailers. And here's something that I want to share with you. So this guy, James O'Keefe, all right? So I'm going to check him out. I'm going to follow him. I'm going to click on his profile. And
okay,
he has, wow, he's got 323,000 followers. That's pretty sweet.
Wow.
This guy's legit, right? Guerrilla journalist, filmmaker, president of at Project Veritas. So now I can mouse over Project Veritas. I can check them out. I can follow him there. But I want to show you an easy way to find the opposite side of the coin that you're looking for. Because you just said you want to find filmmakers and stuff, right?
Yes. To onboard to the platform.
Okay.
That's my core user.
Okay.
And then I need fans to support those filmmakers.
All right. So here's what's cool, at least about Twitter, okay? I mean, we can talk about this for each one, but for the sake of time, I want to give you some real tools. And this is for anybody out there. Find out what your target market is. Then find out keywords that you would use, that those people would use to describe themselves or to talk about themselves. Think about what they would use in their bio, what they would use in their social posts. You said filmmaker. I clicked on filmmaker, and I found out a whole slew of options. And you find somebody, okay, on
yep,
Twitter, you have his tweets, who he is following, his followers, and his likes. So on one side of the fence, you can find somebody through these keywords that wants to be on your platform. Now, this guy has 323,000 people that are, let's just call them followers. Let's say half of those people are fans, and let's say a tenth of them are super fans. So at a minimum, you've got thousands of people that might be great for the other side of the fence. You can click on followers, and now you have access to 323,000 people that are following this filmmaker.
That is amazing. Ryan, thank you so much for sharing that. That's huge. That's like people would pay thousands of dollars to have that kind of target, that list right there. That's absolutely genius. Thank you.
Yeah, and so you can use this type of a strategy in a double-sided marketplace where you need the filmmakers and their fans. So let's say that you invested the time or you had an assistant or somebody who you're working with, and you would do the work on identifying, here's the top 25 filmmakers that are indie, they haven't blown up, but they've got at least 5,000 followers, and I like what they're doing because they're actually producing. Like, you help to find those targets. Then you have somebody go in and straight up follow, research, or message the people who are following that person. And imagine if it's somebody who's maybe a little bit higher end, but you want to get their attention. It's one thing to contact the filmmaker. It's another thing to contact the fans and convince the fans to talk to the filmmaker and say, this is something we would love for you to be on because we have money. We want to give you $10 a month, but you just don't give us the option to. So you can if you get enough, UCI got President Obama to come and speak at commencement by sending four or 5,000 postcards handwritten. And it's like, if you get enough people to create attention around the person you want, you can get their attention that way.
That is like the best growth hack I think I've heard all year.
And it's accessible to everybody. It's right here. It's at least that's on Twitter. And now you can leverage that type of concept on multiple platforms. And it's almost like you're working into the space into the speaker and you're finding the magnet. So I'm going to go real quick with this, is that if I say social media is an amplification tool, think of social media as a speaker. But if you start to dissect that speaker and you go inside the speaker, you can find the components of who's talking, of what they're talking about, and who's listening to what's being talked about. It's like you're going, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids into a speaker, and a lot of that data and information is there for the taking. You just have to know it's there, and you have to take advantage of it to create whatever connections you want.
I love all your actionable steps. You have incredible insight into the processes that we can use. It's one thing to say, to give some abstract idea, but everything that I've seen from you, including your 313, the art of the pitch notes, I helped shoot a video with you last week at the Expert Dojo, and I was actually reviewing it yesterday when you reached out to me to be on this radio show, and just taking notes on that. And I think, could you tell me, it's best to tell me a little bit about how you came up with that theory, the 313, and how it can work and help, people refine their pitch into a few sentences.
Yes, absolutely. And to challenge myself, I only have about 2 minutes to do it, which is the art of the whole thing, right?
Perfect.
So the problem is I've found people have an extremely difficult time, as in it stops them from making money. It stops them from talking to somebody they want to. It is an absolute bloody problem for people to communicate what they do in a short amount of time. It's like, it's public speaking. It's the nightmare of public speaking. And so that's the problem that I'm trying to solve. And I've solved it by a very simple process that allows you to describe yourself, your business, your idea, anything in three sentences, and then one sentence and three words. And this is not for everyone. It's particularly for people who either have huge anxiety about how to describe themselves or have no idea what how they describe the business idea that they have. And so this process, think of it like an everlasting gobstopper of pitching. Okay? So it's like it's there, it's always there, and it never goes away. You just have to build it. So there's kind of a 313 version of my 313, which I don't think I've done before, right?
And the, just really quick, can I just try my my platform in with that system really quick?
You can try really quick. So tell me, what is the problem that you solve?
Problem: it's filmmakers creating sustainable businesses.
Okay, and then what is the solution that you provide?
Film funding platform.
Okay, and who is it for?
For filmmakers to build a fan membership business.
See, there you go. In three sentences, you've at least established the problem, the solution, and the market, and that's enough for me to go off of to have a conversation. Because at the end of the day, the more you say, the less people listen, and the less you say, the more people ask questions, and questions drive conversation, and conversation is what creates connection. So you're onto it, buddy, but I'd love to work with you offline and hone that in a little bit more. Maybe we'll have you back on the show in 6 months and see how everything's going. But we've got to jump now. It's been a lot of fun. You're listening to Ryan Folland here at KUCI in Irvine, 88.9. Get notified with Chai Forrest. Chai, it's been a pleasure, and I really appreciate you coming on.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, Ryan. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And everybody, stick around for Writers on Writing. This is DJ Ginger MC. I am signing out.